All right, friends, here we are. We begin again. Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 111B, second program, page 400. You see the cosmic astrology that DK is hinting at and how carefully one has to read, because he seems to be a master of many things, but a master at choosing just the correct word to indicate precisely what his thought is. We seem to have a bridge operating here, or at least a relationship of causality between an event in the previous solar system, or in a previous solar system. Was it the immediate preceding one, or earlier, in an earlier solar system? He's being careful. He could have said the earlier solar system, but we don't know whether he means that or not. But we have this kind of causative bridge operating. The moon, we're not told really that the moon became a dead planet in the previous solar system, but it is implied, at least, that if our planetary logos representing a certain chakra in the solar logos, and basically it's the base of the spine chakra which he represents, though he may be involved triangularly in other chakras. I've often thought that three planets are involved in every one of the chakras of the solar logos, but that remains to be proven. That this event which occurred at that time led to the moon becoming a dead planet in this particular solar system. And no doubt this has caused our planetary logos a great deal of difficulty, because he made some kind of systemic mistake in allowing certain energies to be expressed in an unchecked manner when they should have been restrained. About this we can know so little. We know very little about the so-called sin of the Buddha, and which DK says is most understandable, but when we it's the sin of a premature compassion or lingering compassion. And we see that on the higher turn of the spiral, that sin of the Buddha has its prototype in the sin of our planetary logos with respect to the Lord of the Moon Chain, I suppose, and some sort of premature compassion was exerted, which led to a disruption of the system. And it seems that that feeding into this and leading into this was an event which occurred in a previous solar system altogether and may have conditioned energies and forces of that moon chain in such a way that when premature compassion was exerted, things got out of control, leading to the death of the form of that particular chain. And from what I understand, the Lord of the Moon Chain, being an emanative extension of our planetary logos, is active in relation to our fourth chain, along with and cooperating with the Lord of the fourth chain, also an emanative extension of our planetary logos. Well, you know, you might say these are aspects of astrology with which we have no business to deal. You know, they are beyond our ken, but DK hints at them, and possibly by thinking about them, we can tell something about the use of these energies in relation to our individual lives and our group lives and life right here on Earth. So much of the contrast and the battle between these moon chain energies and earth chain energies are very effective, causatively effective on our planet. They are big issues which we have to work out on the human level. There may be in process of being worked out on other levels as well, but we human beings have this legacy of the energies and forces of the moon chain. And perhaps this is a space right here. Our planetary globe is a space, and our fourth chain is a space in which two agendas are proceeding simultaneously, the uncompleted moonchain agenda and the agenda that was slated by the plan to be operative in this fourth chain. So there are many cross currents, and we do experience them. And there's something about the sign Taurus which conduces to the experience of these cross currents, because the moon, with its relationship to that event in the previous solar system, is exalted in Taurus, very powerful. Through desire translated into terms of spiritual will, the spiritual will being a higher prototype of desire. Interesting that, you know, when you think about it, that, I wonder how I can, when you think about the chart here, let's see if I can find this. Okay, that's not it. But the next one is that the chart, the big tabulation that we often look at, shows this the plane of spiritual will to be a water plane. How interesting. This is the relationship between spiritual will and desire, desire and spiritual will. The astral plane and the atmic plane are both active. One is the third and one is the sixth. And DK has told us how important is the relationship not only of the one to the two and the two to the four, but of the three to the six. So the third plane and the sixth plane are related. They're both water planes, in a sense. Although, in another sense, the atmic plane is called the etheric plane, aether, A-E, we do know that a will and desire have an intimate relationship, and this is reinforced here in our chart. Okay. So, the exaltation of the moon is the symbol of the transformation or translation of desire into spiritual will, or into terms of spiritual will. Desire plane has a connection to the Buddhic plane in terms of love, but also in terms of will. There is much of will in desire, and desire has its first ray aspect as well, which connects with the spiritual spiritual will. And as I said, the term translation seems all often to be used when we elevate a lower energy found in the three lower worlds, either 18 subplanes or 21 subplanes, into the cosmic ethers. Translation is the word. It's almost as if it's those energies and forces are being translated into a new cosmic etheric language. So we have transmutation, transformation, transfiguration, translation. Kind of wonder where transubstantiation comes in there. Maybe it does. Not necessarily in the same sense that the Catholic Church uses it, but as occultists would use it. Sometime I'll have to explore that. So this elevation of the moon, in a way representing desire, and Vulcan representing spiritual will, is a process. It's a translation process. And you know, I have often thought that Vulcan should be connected with the plane of spiritual will, with the atmic plane, just as Saturn is. There's not particularly a relationship here between Libra and Vulcan, but the sun falls in Libra, and the sun oftentimes represents Vulcan. And the true source of spiritual will, from a practical perspective, as humanity, even advanced humanity, can access it, is the atmic plane, and spiritual will is Vulcan. So Vulcan Saturn, you know, trying to think about the symbol, the hammer and the sickle. It's so much the symbol, the will, the spiritual will is so much, in a way, the symbol of the former Soviet Union. The hammer, Vulcan, and the sickle, the reaper, is Saturn. We can see how much will and its relation to Virgo and to matter and to the proletariat, to the mass, beating the mass into the right type of shape. Virgo can, you know, represent the people who normally are on that stage of the ladder of evolution, that they are the servants of those who are higher. And it's always the way it is. You always serve those who are higher as you rise. But beating them into shape and applying discipline and karma to them, perhaps that was the intention in the so-called dictatorship of the proletariat. This would have been, of course, reversing the hierarchy, putting things upside down, and it had a great leveling effect so that no one was considered better than anyone else, which denied all of the soul's experience, mistakenly. But you can see a deeper purpose here in the shaping of the fashioning of the masses, those with simply personality experience and not spiritual experience, so that they would respond more definitely to the spiritual will. And they were brought into the Virgo petal of the knowledge petals, which is the third petal in the ignorance tier, as it were, hall of ignorance, where involuntary sacrifices were required of them. When you see the way the Soviet Union treated its soldiers, you know, one gun for two soldiers, when one is killed, the other picks up the gun, and so forth. But, you know, being forced into battle in a completely unprepared manner, 20 million people dying, and I suppose many of them soldiers being compelled to make involuntary sacrifices, you see that the will often forces a kind of servitude, which Virgo represents, and that sacrifice pedal represents. And here we have Vulcan and Saturn, both powerful in relation to Virgo, beating down upon the mass of human beings who were required to rise above themselves, forced by the Shambhala energies to do that. You think of Stalin, whatever you may think of him, you know, DK tells us that he is a disciple of Shambhala. A lot of people consider him, you know, fairly gray, and, you know, he may have killed, under his orders, 30 million people, something of that nature, even more than Hitler, whatever you may think of him. Through the industrialization of the Soviet Union, forced to an extreme degree by the necessities of war and all the rest, he really was contributing to the shaping up of the masses under the pressure of Saturn and Vulcan. That's a bit of a digression, but I saw a few connections in there which I had not seen. You know, I'm grateful for the opportunity, as rambling as it may occasionally be, to discuss this book line by line and the correlations which may arise through this discussion and the new light which may arise with those correlations, the flashing forth of light under Mercury, when two hitherto unrelated areas of knowledge are brought into meaningful relationship, hopefully meaningful. So anyway, through desire translated into terms of spiritual will, the form is esoterically exalted, brought into a condition of real responsiveness to the higher energies, and of this fact, the exaltation of the moon in Taurus is a symbol. In other words, we do want the moon to be exalted. We want the moon to be exalted into a state of radiant elevation, using the illuminative power of Vulcan, because Vulcan really does bring the hidden light forth, the hidden light of matter forth into expression. It's usually the dark light. It's Cancerian in its nature. It's the dark light which has to be brought into visibility by the power of Vulcan. When you think about the moon in relation to Cancer, you can also see the association of Vulcan, especially in the less developed people. In some way, Vulcan suppresses the light for a while. You know, it holds it down. It won't let it free. And in other ways, later, it releases it and lifts matter towards heaven. Usually Vulcan is the downward-pointing arrow, and Pluto is the upward-pointing arrow. But it's possible to reverse Vulcan and all that it has impressed upon matter can cause matter to reverse its direction under the impulse of a rising Vulcan. To this, the ordinary astrological symbol of the bull's horns testifies. This is the crescent moon. You know, it's above the head of the bull, so in a way it's exalted. And also the symbol for the destructive nature of the form life of the bull. Destructive nature. So the goring and rending by the horns, separating and not unifying. Of course, if it were the High Priestess, the tarot card that is demonstrating the crescent moon, then we would have an entirely different process at work. We would have more the rendering luminous of matter. But the horns can be destructive, or the horns can represent the rising of matter into responsiveness to the greater energies. Their vibratory capacity is increased, and Vulcan, you see, is the planet associated with the systemic law of vibration. The hammer stroke displaces things the way they are and sets them into vibration. So rhythmic impacts associated with the law of vibration, and with a sufficient elevation of vibration to make all that is ruled by the moon responsive to the higher forces. When things are inert and heavy and the vibration is slow, then of course the form will not be responsive. The matter in the form will not be responsive to the higher impacts. And you kind of think about Uranus in relation to Taurus, Uranus the heavenly one, representing these very, very high vibrations, and the Taurus resisting those vibrations because of its inertness. So the crescent moon, the bull's horns, the crescent moon, and also the symbol of the destructive nature of the form, rending the form, tearing it apart, goring it, separating it, not unifying it. Forget not that in this connection, the destruction or death of the form and the ending of form influence thereby is the goal of the process which changes desire into aspiration. So when we are detached from our attachments through possibly through the destruction of those forms to which we were attached, we see that they are actually of lesser value, and we begin to aspire towards our treasures in heaven rather than the treasures on earth, which the moth and the mouse can eat. Forget not that in this connection, the destruction or death of the form, now interesting that this death of the form can be connected with Vulcan and with the moon in Taurus, as well as with the moon in Scorpio, where it falls, and the ending of form influence thereby, it no longer has that magnetic, captivating effect upon the consciousness, is the goal of the process which changes desire into aspiration. So this, we've talked quite a bit in this chapter about the changing of desire into aspiration, desire, aspiration, intelligent activity, leading finally to illumination, but this does not occur without suffering. So rending, you know, the shaking of the man plant, the awakening of the sleeping soul, the tearing our consciousness away from its identifications, this occurs accompanied by suffering to the consciousness, later followed by joy and bliss and the realization of what has really happened. But when we're going through it, it takes a long time to realize that the detachment process is really a phase of the liberation process and leads to joy and bliss. Usually there's the agony that occurs, you know, the agony of the death drama. Most people don't die consciously. They don't die willfully. And they don't want to die, except if the suffering has become extreme and then there's an acquiescence and the other world has begun to show itself. So forget not that in this connection, the destruction or death of the form and the ending of form influence is the goal of the process, which changes desire into aspiration. So rending, tearing, suffering, detaching, all this helps change normal, lower desire into aspiration. Oop, atomic subplane, aspiration. So there's, you know, the Buddha has offered a conscious way here. He's offered the means by which we can deliberately detach through the use of the mind and not simply be forced to detach by Pluto and by Vulcan and torn away from our identifications by forces beyond our control. We have to be the force which disengages us from our normal attachments. And this we do by illumined understanding and seeing the place that the item to which we are attached really occupies in the scheme of things, seeing its relative valueness compared with that which it represents, which is true being or suchness or substance or the presence, the reality. It's just an externalization of reality, and it is empty in itself. It's a vacuity. It is not real. It is a precipitation of that which is real. But it takes a long time and much suffering to see this. But then nothing is ever lost, as we are told, when we turn to this great formula, which is found on 285 of Discipleship in the New Age, and the final statement of it, I really would recommend reading. It's so fantastic, you know. It says, basically, being cries forth and says, death, untranslatable, we don't know what that word is, but death crumbles all, existence disappears, yet all for A remains, untouched, immutably the same. So all of these forms of existence, they disappear, and yet, even though they disappear since they are actually empty, all for A remains, untouched, immutably the same as ever, which is the unchanging essence God is. And I guess the Buddha was a great revealer of being and of suchness, thatness, that which cannot be defined in any way except that it is. Any attribution given to it is in a way a lie or a partiality. So anyway, we're on our way. We have people who study this kind of thing and read the Bailey books and try to apply them to their life, or the ageless wisdom in any of its forms, are involved in transmuting desire into aspiration. And this is done very much under Taurus, the highest form of aspirational idealism, being found in Taurus. Uranus, the planet of the hidden mystery. Oh, I love that. Also the heavenly one, you know. The mystery planet that Madame Blavatsky talks about, that was known to the initiates but not known to the common people with their ordinary gods. Well, at least the fact that it was a planet was not known. Uranus, the planet of the hidden mystery and one of the most occult of the planets, along with Neptune, I suppose, falls in this sign, producing the accentuation and the sharp division between body and soul, which is so much a characteristic of the Gemini subject, Taurian subject. Now, what I was going to say is we see how the succeeding sign always corrects a liability of the preceding sign. So let's just say if there is a sharp division between body and soul in Taurus, this is corrected. In Gemini, where there is established a communicative relationship between soul and body, body here representing personality. So a sharp division between body and soul, and Uranus will represent the soul and the spirit, and its testimony is effectively earthed in Taurus. But, of course, it doesn't remain earth, does it? Because it causes such a disturbance in the earth that we get those shake-ups or earthquakes which change the lay of the land everywhere and which actually bring a form of liberation. So even though we can think that the electricity of Uranus is effectively housed and grounded and buried, it's going to assert its spirit power and shake things up so that its entombment, its imprisonment, does not last. I'm reminded that lightning, of course, I don't know the technicalities. I mean, I once saw about all that, but there are sort of electrical filaments which come up from the earth which attract the lightning from above. So it's not just that lightning from heaven descends and hits the earth, but there is an attraction set up by the earth through certain energy forms which is part of the process by which the lightning descends. So we can have real shake-ups going on with Uranus and Taurus and a real transmutation of matter, we might say, because one of the signs of inertia is Taurus, and Uranus is a planet of etherealization and translation, even more effectively than Mercury, I would say, translation of that which is dense into that which is cosmically etheric. So this is a way of really, it's a very willful position because the Vulcan is there and the willfulness of the Taurian is present, and then we add to it this tremendous logoic will of Uranus, we can find very powerful dictatorial tendencies here. You might say, well, the Taurian can't be transformed because Uranus is falling in that sign and is effectively muted or subdued. But Uranus is so strong that that fall will not remain a quiet process. At some point, there will be the shake-up. Okay, so it prepares, what prepares? Uranus prepares the inner man for the sharp interplay and conflict of the next sign, eventually leading to that fluid, interplay. Which helps each brother swing into the orbit of the other. So at first, yes, great differences are evident in the Gemini person, the ability to be very dual, but eventually that interplay sort of along Mercury and the figure eight is established, a kind of antikorana in various phases, and eventually there is a fluid communication between the two, which is not found in Taurus. Okay, let's see, what else here? The presence, therefore, of the exalted moon and the fallen Uranus gives a marvelous picture of man's history during the stage of personality development. Indeed it does. The moon of the form is right up there, and heaven is unknown, effectively earthed. Okay. So heaven, or the heavenly one, okay, heaven, or the heavenly one, is effectively earth in Taurus, and I would say at first. The moon is exalted, and the form presents a great resistance to the expression of Uranian spirit. The presence, therefore, of the exalted moon, let's see here, of the exalted moon and the fallen Uranus gives a marvelous picture of man's history, and it's a long history, during the stage of personality development, and it's millions of years long, and power, even for the egoistic man, even for the egotistical man who is relatively highly developed, the higher meaning of Uranus is subdued. Though Uranus can produce the personality dictator as well. And this will be revealed when we have more understanding of the stages and statistically induced understanding, the stages through which the human being passes. The task of Uranus hidden in the depths, see, hidden in the depths, effectively earthed in so many people, is to awaken and evoke the intuitive response of Taurus. Now remember, the real awakening of intuition comes at first in Gemini. Somewhere here, I think, page 119, roughly. Let's see if that's there. We have the sense of duality, and then we're talking about the mutable cross, and you know all of the confinement of the mutable cross. But then the man begins to dream of stability, of order, changes, and of union with that which he senses to be the most real part of himself. And here it is. The mystical vision emerges into his consciousness, and he becomes aware of the higher self through the first faint flickerings of the intuition. FFF, first faint flickerings of the intuition. Okay, let's see if I can. Yes, I can. Okay. But still here in Taurus, we have here the function of Uranus, because Uranus gives the lightning bolt of realization that we often call intuition, you know, when the lightning lights up the dark sky and we see things that were completely hidden just for a moment, just a flash. That's called perhaps, or at least a very good symbol of the intuition. And when that flash of intuition becomes a sustained realization, we do have initiation. The task of Uranus hidden in the depths is to awaken and evoke the intuitive response of Taurus to an ever-increasing light until such time that full illumination is achieved, and also the development of spiritual consciousness, substituting these higher soul aspects for the lower form reactions. So basically here what we have is that Uranus contributes to the growing of the of the light of intuition, of illumination. So these flashes of illumination increase, and gradually there is, if you think about it, what a combination it would be, illuminative Taurus and revelatory Uranus. At a high stage of evolution, these could be very powerful for illumination. And what we should do, I suppose, is go to our list of famous people and find out how many of these illumined types did have Uranus and Taurus. That I can recommend. I'm not going to go off and do that at the moment, but I think it would be most interesting. I have it's kind of a sample of a few hundred famous people, but it's just, of course, not enough at all. And there's so many famous individuals of high rank over the millennia whose horoscope should be known. And then statistically, we'd be able to see what they actually have succeeded in doing and what their psycho-spiritual state was and how it correlated with certain signs and positions. The task of Uranus, hidden in the depths, is to awaken the intuitive response on Taurus, which, you know, at first can be pretty inert, I suppose, to an ever-increasing light until such time that full illumination is achieved. In other words, we could say that a Uranus in Taurus could lead to the illumination or Satori or transfiguration, if it's operating correctly. So the breaking forth of the, that's interesting. In Zen, it's said that Satori can be so sudden. You know, one minute you're unillumined or unenlightened, and the next minute you are. You know, and we're told how for the great Buddhist sage Tsongkhapa, a fly was his illuminator. Suddenly. So the suddenness of illumination can be understood in relation to Uranus in Taurus, even though the effective earthing of heaven is also the case for a long time. What really operates to suppress the higher energies in the lower type of individual can operate to reveal those energies in a higher type of individual, and so, as I said, the fall becomes, in a way, an exaltation. So we're awakening here to an ever-increasing light until such a time that full illumination is achieved, and also the development of the spiritual consciousness, substituting these higher soul aspects for the lower form reactions. So these would be cosmic etheric responses instead of, and the soul, in a way, of course, is the spiritual triad, or at least a more planetary type of consciousness is found within the triad than is found in the usual causal body soul limitations. It's all consciousness. It just depends on the field of matter forms for which the consciousness is working. And there's a much more extensive sort of non-local field for consciousness to operate in within the triad than is the case within the causal body. All right, so it is interesting to note that in Scorpio, Uranus is exalted, which gives indication of the success of the task which the Uranian forces undertook. Achievement is attained. So either one of these signs can be relatively a sign of achievement. A process begun in Taurus can be achieved in Scorpio. A process begun in Scorpio can be achieved in Taurus. The liberating power from the grasp of the Hydra can also lead to the full illumination in Taurus, which is a Buddhic or Atmic or even, in a sense, monadic, as Taurus has so much to do with Shambhala and the unfettered enlightenment. Think about that, unfettered enlightenment. The breaking of chains, well, Vulcan can do it, but Uranus is really a shatterer of chains, and the greatest light being indicated in Taurus. So think about those two words, unfettered enlightenment, and realize how much they are represented by Uranus in Taurus. just came to me, I mean, you know, more impressively than usual, how the release through this fall into an exaltation release of the greatest light can occur with Uranus and Taurus, and a sudden release at that. I mean, there are all degrees of enlightenment. Sometimes when you read the Zen literature and other literature having to do with sudden illumination, you think that that's it. You're illumined once and for all, forever, at a certain point. It just can't be the case, because illumination is a progressive factor, and there are so many different degrees of intensity of light. What about the illumination of our planetary logos? What about the illumination of our solar logos? Our solar logos is not yet an illumined solar logos, hasn't taken the third cosmic initiation, and certainly this is true of our planetary logos. So all kinds of degrees of revelation of the light lie ahead of us, and there is no final sudden Satori. But there are sudden Satoris, and I suppose the very first one is shocking in the extreme. We might say the shock of enlightenment, and again, that's Uranus in Taurus. I'm really beginning to realize something about this fall nature here, the shock of enlightenment, Uranus in Taurus. So we should never look at a chart and say, oh my goodness, you know, your heavenly potentials are effectively earthed here. There's no way you're going to become an illumined being, because all of the intuition is buried by the earth in Taurus. No, this is only true for some types of people who have not yet reversed the wheel. And these sudden flashes of blinding light, you can really understand how they would be associated with Uranus in Taurus. Mars is in detriment in this sign. Its activity adds constantly to the natural warlike nature of Taurus. This is so interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about Taurus, you think, well, this is a, you know, a bovine sign. I mean, the bull is out there pleasantly grazing under Venus, smelling the flowers. You know, Ferdinand the bull is sort of Venus and Taurus, smelling the flowers. But DK calls this a sign which is naturally warlike. So what are the other rays? Well, in a way, the fourth ray is coming through Taurus, and it says of the fourth ray, and the Blessed One, loaded with the panoply of war, he stood midway looking two ways. The fourth ray is the ray of war, and it comes prominently through Taurus, but I've often thought that the first ray has a strong place in this shambolically related sign, and the sixth ray as well as because desire, sixth ray, is finally translated into spiritual will. So this gives us a different perspective on Taurus, naturally warlike. And of course, the word naturally should not be dismissed. DK may mean what he says. He may be relating this to the forces of nature. But the potency of the Taurian struggle, there's Ray 4 again, right? Ray 4 is so great, esoterically speaking, maybe we don't notice it on the outside, just as many Scorpionic individuals deep six their struggle, that the effect of Mars is lost in the larger whole. So I guess it's not so noticeable. It adds to the glamour and confusion, and yet holds within itself hope for the struggling man, because Mars is related, you know, Mars is related to aspiration, which Taurus cultivates and releases. So it is not entirely meaningless or useless within the Taurian whole. I've known some people with Mars and Taurus, and they really do have a struggle with the elemental nature. Generally, the elemental nature is quite strong and can be, once harnessed, really used as an instrument of the soul. But at first, everything instinctual and the lower desire nature comes to the fore and overpowers through desire what is better known by the higher will. And that, of course, goes into transition and eventually the general battle, though powerfully increased, offers the opportunity for liberation. In other words, idealism emerges in Taurus through the help of Mars. Aspirational idealism of the highest kind is found in Taurus, and Mars, when functioning properly as idealism rather than desire, is going to help with this emergence. But, you know, some things stand out. DK's different interpretation of astrology, which counteracts so much of what is said in conventional astrology. We have to pay close attention and not allow our thoughts to crystallize in relation to the conventional astrology. I mean, so many of us who started astrology with the books available and not DK's books may have many crystallizations of thought which have to be broken down if a truer perspective about astrology is to be given. So you can understand why a lot of astrologers reading Master DK here just reject what he says, because it would mean the rebuilding, the reformulation of so much of what they have learned. Taurus has to do with the accumulation of knowledge. Here comes Master DK as Uranus. He breaks that knowledge down and says, look, it's not valuable. Something else is truer. People are attached to their knowledge, Taurus, and they don't want to give it up, you know. So there are ways to try to make an accommodation and try to make a compromise, and to a degree that works, but eventually the esoteric perspective has to be adopted. It's taken me a long time to break down some of those crystallizations, and I haven't succeeded entirely. I oftentimes find the words of books I've read 50 years ago on astrology entering as if it were truth, as if they were truth, and they are not. So there's a hierarchy of revelation here, and we can read the books of ordinary people, such as we are, and say, okay, there's some benefit here. But when we get the words of a master, we really get something. We really get something from a heavenly perspective, from an archetypal Uranian perspective, and why not use those if we can just detach ourselves? So constantly in this sign comes the emphasis upon struggle. He really takes us into the fourth ray of this sign and into the impact of the will, Vulcanian aspect upon the form. You know, it's not just a sign of inert, easygoing placidity. It is a cosmic, planetary, and individual struggle, meaning Taurus must contribute to the struggle of our solar logos and our planetary logos. Let's put that down. We can understand Taurus contributing to the struggles of our solar logos and planetary logos, as well as to the struggles of man. For desire will underlies the manifested activities of the Logos, the lion of cosmic will. That's what he is called, our solar Logos anyway. Our solar Logos, the lion of cosmic will. Now, we can't really say that he has completely developed his cosmic will, because he's not yet a sacred solar Logos. He hasn't even taken the cosmic third initiation. These are just words to us, but, you know, they give us a structure whereby we can compare the progress of our solar logos analogously to the progress of man. Anyway, desire will, and especially desire, because he is a Buddhic, astral Buddhic solar logos at this time, desire will underlie the manifested activities of the logos, our logos, the planetary life. And we have a very willful planetary logos, but his first ray monad is still esoterically non-effective, his second-ray soul is emerging, and his desire nature is alive and well, the planetary life, and of man, and also of all forms in nature. So it's all a movement towards the center, isn't it? You know, the outer form reaches out until it learns to reach in, and allowing will to take the place of desire, which happens at the second initiation to a great extent, and which happens in the big struggle between Mars and Vulcan at the second initiation, and even more so a Mars-Vulcan struggle at the third initiation. It is the struggle of that which is deeply hidden in darkness to reach the light of day. So the entombed spirit seeks the light of day. Now, this light, that's law of disintegration, that's not it. Light of day. But when you hear of these different kinds of light, you know, you're thinking immediately of zodiacal light, and of course, think of Scorpio, whose form of light is the light of day. So Uranus, deeply hidden in Taurus, and the basic dark light found at the depths of form, reaches forward through destruction and liberation into the light of day, which is revealed in Scorpio. Remember that both of these signs are signs of illumination. I pointed out that the 5- or 6-fold meditation process, beginning at Leo, and by the time it gets to Scorpio, it says illumination, doesn't it? And Taurus rules the greatest light. So both of the signs yield the great light eventually. And both are signs of darkness in which consciousness is immersed in form, Scorpio being the triple sign indicating the form, and Taurus being a dense earth sign at first in a way. So it is the struggle of that which is deeply hidden in darkness to reach the light of day. It is the struggle of the hidden soul to dominate and control the outer form. It can do this via Taurus or Scorpio. It can do this via Vulcan. The struggle to transmute desire into aspiration. And either one of the signs will give us this transmutation. But especially since we are studying Taurus, we are talking about the rampant desire nature of the bull who sees red. The fact that the bull sees red is going to relate him, interestingly enough, to the first ray or to the sixth ray. Red is found in relation to both of these rays. The struggle to transmute desire attached to the lower worlds into aspiration, which is the seeking of a kind of attachment to higher things, and aspiration into the will to achieve. We do get a sense of a very determined will towards liberation in Taurus. Will to liberation, that's will to love, liberation, and will to achieve, in Taurus. So once there is this fixed determination to move forward, it's as if nothing can easily stop the onward rush of the bull of God, especially when wisely directed by a growing vision, which can come from Taurus itself or from Sagittarius. Taurus rushes blindly until Sagittarius directs. So DK is giving us theme and variations here on the theme of struggle. It is the struggle to attain the goal which an increasing light reveals. Those lightning flashes of Uranus in relation to Taurus become more constant, and the vision of what is to be attained is revealed. There's always something other than that which is earthed in matter, or the true home of that which is earthed in matter, and gradually the light increases. So ever in Taurus there is an increasing light until we have the Satori or enlightenment experience, which is unitive, holistic, and reveals the essential detachment of the observer from that which is observed. So potent is this struggle that on the ordinary wheel It culminates prior to the reentry in Aries of the soul seeking incarnation, let form again be sought, by the fixed desire growing steadily stronger to follow the wheel of rebirth. There are things one wants on the wheel of rebirth. One is attached to the things of the three worlds, and one wants those things. So a very, very strong desire is built up in Taurus if a person is not yet on the reversed wheel. So to follow the rebirth wheel of rebirth, on the reversed progress around the wheel, the struggle is to overcome and destroy all that has been so laboriously achieved upon the ordinary wheel, and to demonstrate in Scorpio. Notice that word demonstrate, because it's a triple sign having to do with the three lower worlds, through the terrific tests there applied, that the form no longer controls, but that the lessons learned through the use of form have been released, have been retained. Okay, I think we are at that point, quite close to that point. I'll finish a little more. The struggle is to achieve initiation in Capricorn and thus release the soul. So many kinds of struggle here, and Buddhism gave this release of the soul through detachment, Buddhism being a very Taurian method. The struggle is to achieve initiation in Capricorn and thus release the soul from the revolving wheel altogether and achieve final liberation from the thraldom, the imprisonment of desire, and from form control of any kind. When you think about how we use the word glamour and glamorous and how we use the word enthralled, oh, I'm enthralled, you know, I'm enthralled by you, enthralled by him or her. It means I'm imprisoned by that to which I am attracted. So, you look very glamorous, meaning you look very attractive, falsely attractive, and imprisoning. So we have a great reversal of ideas operating here, and we need to see the true meaning of the words and concepts that we use in a reversed manner. We use them in a reversed manner because most of us have not reversed the wheel, and those of us who have reversed the wheel should be able to understand, thraldom is not what we want. We don't want to become enthralled by anything, and we don't want to become glamorized or attracted by something which is so glamorous and seductive. We don't want that because we've had enough of it, and it has led to millions of years of pain and entrapment, and we want freedom. So the effect of Uranus in both of these signs can be very, very powerful, shaking things up and finally destroying that which contains the or restrains the consciousness. Well, what I'll say here is that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 111B, page something. We're almost ready to go into the page 402. We just have a couple more pages to go, then we have to get into the Decanes. A few more of programs on Taurus, I guess, and then we're ready to start the second part of the book, A Daunting Prospect. As DK seems to say, it's the most important part of the book, especially in the science of triangles being discussed. So, beginning of Esoteric Astrology 111, C. No, we don't want that. I wonder. C, page 402. I think when we start the next program here in just a minute, we will, why not start it right now? Okay, why not start it right now? We have the proper timing, I think. Pretty much.